Hello, and welcome to Season 3 of Medical Women Talking. I'm Jane Dacre, and in this season, I wanted to speak to more wonderful and inspiring medical women, including people who are early and mid-career. These women are all making a name for themselves in their respective fields. They're what I like to call rising stars and will be influencing all our futures.
Dr. Kate Ordage, a consultant radiologist at Barts and also an honorary senior clinical lecturer. Hello, Kate, and thank you so much for joining me.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for inviting me to talk on your podcast.
I think it'll be a pleasure. So first of all, can we start just at the beginning, really, with a summary of why you went into medicine and how's your career been so far?
Well, I guess when I was a little girl, I wanted to be a scientist, actually. I wanted to follow in the footsteps of my father, who was a physicist and an engineer. And he was very active in MRI physics. So as his PhD, he worked under Professor Sir Peter Mansfield at Nottingham University and created the first MRI machine in the UK. So wow. I was always interested in physics, actually. And when it got to A-levels, I sat down with my dad and my mum and I said, look, I really want to do science. I was thinking about physics. Maybe I could go and work in MRI one day. And he said, look, Kate, you're really clever, but you have something else. You can talk to people. And why don't you consider medicine? And that was the first time anyone had ever said to me, why don't you consider being a doctor? I'd never actually thought about it.
How old were you at the time?
I think I was 16 or 17. It was just when I was choosing A-levels. Okay. And then he sent me to see one of his friends, one of his collaborators, Prof. Nikki Robertson, who was a neonatologist, a lovely woman. And she spent about half an hour with me talking me through medical training, medical school, how it works, what I can expect. And it was really my first introduction. I didn't know anyone who was a doctor. None of my parents' friends were doctors. So this is really the first doctor I'd met who I, you know, sat down with and talked about what it meant to be a doctor and, you know, what her motivations were. And at the end of that, I thought, yes, this is something I could do. This is actually something I'm really interested in. And why have I never thought about it before?
Okay, so then you thought about it and you...
I thought about it, yes.
And you applied to medical school?
I applied to medical school. I was the first one in the history of the school to apply to medical school. I was a bit... I was a test case.
What kind of school was it?
It was their lovely little girls' comprehensive school in Chislehurst. And at the time, they were a language college. It was called Bullerswood School for Girls. And they had focused quite heavily on languages. They were a very good comprehensive school at the time.
But you didn't like languages, or you can do languages as well?
That's a funny story, Jane, because I dropped both languages at GCSE level, thinking I'd never need them again and I needed to focus on the science, and ended up marrying a Frenchman. So I really wish I'd done French A level, but anyway, I'm catching up now.
Good, very good. So how did you get into medical school? Was that all straightforward?
I think at the time it was much easier to get into medical school. I mean, it was still very challenging, but I had a lot of people willing to help me in the end. You know, I had mock interviews. I went and visited all my dad's friends who were doctors in and around UCL, spoke to them. A few of them read my personal statement. So I was really lucky to have had that mentorship at a young age. And I think that's what helped me get in. And, you know, I got good marks in my exams. So that helped as well. I was very motivated. And I think everyone could see I was motivated.
Excellent. And a hard worker, sounds like. Conscientious.
Well, I guess so. As the eldest child, we're often like that, aren't we?
Yeah. So then medical school?
Yes, so I went to UCL, and that was more of a financial decision, I suppose, because I'd gotten into King's and UCL, and my best friend was going to King's to study medicine. We'd both gotten in. But UCL, my dad was on the staff, so I got a 50% discount.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. And then when I did visit the campus, I sort of fell in love with the history of it. You know, its location and the fact, indeed, actually, that it was the first university in the world, I think, to accept women and people of colour. So, you know, what a great history.
So that, but that wasn't so clear, was it, at the time? Did you have to look that up or was it something they were very proud of?
I think it was something that they were proud of at the time. I remember, yeah, someone had told me this on a tour around the campus.
Wow.
Yeah, someone very forward thinking.
Yes, yes. Because the women thing was probably related to the Royal Free.
Oh, so was the Royal Free the first medical school to accept women?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, how did you get on at UCL?
Well, I quite liked it. It was really great, actually, to be surrounded by people from all over the world who come to study medicine. And the, you know, what a wide variety of hospitals and specialities and all sorts of different pathology that you're exposed to living in London.
So you're now a radiologist. Your father was involved in MRI.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Did you consider doing other specialties or was radiology just the one right from the beginning?
You know, I had known since the age of 17 that I'd wanted to be a radiologist because I had a range work experience once I decided I wanted to get into medical school at the local hospital. And the only place that would take me was the radiography department. And I spent a fabulous 2 weeks hanging out with the radiographers, sort of helping them. I think at the time it was the old films in little plastic packets. So I would take them and I would put them through the processor and take the film out at the other end and stick it up on the light box. It was such good fun. They really welcomed me. Yeah, and ever since then, I was just fascinated. I'd always loved physics and anatomy. And it was something I was so interested in. It's sort of like, I feel like being a radiologist is like being a bit of a sleuth. You have limited clinical details and you're expected to, you know, find out what's going on with the patient just based on what you can see on the scan. And I know a lot of it is routine, but every now and then you do get a case which really piques your interest.
And radiologist friends of mine, or some in particular, have the most amazing ability to look at detail in pictures, any old picture, as far as I can see. An incredible skill.
I describe it as being a very highly trained monkey sometimes.
So when you qualified, did you just go straight into that career track?
No, my career path was quite complicated and varied, actually. I had done my F1 at King's, which was a great little hospital, really nice people. And then I was sent off to Gillingham at the Medway Maritime Hospital as my F2. It was at the time when they were pairing F1 and F2 jobs. And I'd had a bit of a miserable time doing very busy jobs down in Gillingham. And I applied for radiology. And I didn't put any second choices down. So I put my top four choices of radiology training schemes and nothing else, and then failed to get into a single one of them that year.
Oh, depressing. So why had you had a miserable time? Sorry to go back a bit. What had made your time in Gillingham miserable?
I think I was just far from home and my friends and my family. And yeah. I was working very busy jobs. I did 4 months of obs and gynae, which I found very difficult. I don't know if you've read This Is Going to Hurt.
Yes, I have. Yes.
So a lot of his experiences I recognise as being similar to some experiences I've had.
Can you give an example, just in case people haven't read the book?
So Adam Key talks about his registrar training in obs and gynae, and there's some really heartfelt and upsetting stories in there, but also the stories of how, you know, medicine sort of erodes into his work-life balance and destroys his relationships and, you know, prevents him from doing everyday normal things like going to weddings and parties and missing his Christmas dinner because he falls asleep in the car. And it was really that level of exhaustion and, you know, the constant emotional trauma of dealing with these very life and death situations, you know, getting regularly soaked in blood and amniotic fluid, having to change your scrubs multiple times, and, you know, just really sad stories. And you know, I don't know how much I should go into it, but things like, you know, having to call time of death on a baby who was stillborn when the mother was an intravenous drug user. And, you know, the unborn child has been dead for a long time. It was it was quite horrific for someone to deal with when they're, you know, in their early 20s.
Yes,
and at the time there wasn't much support. It's like, you know, so you're just kind of left alone to sink or swim, really.
And so you got to a stage where you didn't want to do that, quite understandably so. And then what you thought was automatically going to happen didn't. So where did that leave you?
Cast adrift, really. But, you know, I'd always wanted to pursue the science and do a bit of research. And I had tried over the summer at medical school to do a few research projects. It never really gone anywhere, though. So I started looking around to do a master's, or just, you know, to do a PhD even, and looking at, so naturally I turned to UCL and I found a, what they called a capacity building PhD studentship, where you would start with a master's of research. And then you had actually the opportunity to go to have your funding provided by the Medical Research Council and go and sort of interview all the different supervisors and pick the supervisor and project after a year that you thought would be, you know, a good fit for you, which was an amazing opportunity, really. So I was very, I guess, very lucky in the end to get a place, one of only 10 places on that programme for that year.
Well, actually, probably pretty good. You were probably pretty top notch to get that. So what did you do your research into?
So I started off looking at cell tracking and cell therapies. And in my master's, we were looking at using iron oxide nanoparticles to do hypothermia and kill cancer cells. So we come up with a little machine and a nice model to see if that was effective. And it, you know, it was pretty interesting, but it wasn't really, there wasn't much imaging involved in it. So then I had to try and turn this into an imaging project. And it began with looking at stem cell therapy and putting, you know, the stem cells will take up the iron oxide nanoparticles, and then I could use MRI to track them throughout the body. And then I soon realized that was not very good. So I started looking at other things like bioluminescence imaging. And then I realized radio labeling was actually very, very interesting. And our lab had bought a little SPECT CT scanner. So I started radio labeling cells and seeing if I could track them.
And could you?
Yes, and I got some very, very pretty pictures.
Fantastic.
But that's what really started my interest in nuclear medicine, which I ended up subspecialising in.
Ah, okay. So then how did you get in? You got your PhD. How did you get into radiology?
Well, my supervisor was always very supportive about me returning back to medicine because he was a respiratory physician himself. So he'd always encouraged me to keep my hand in, and we'd written a case report, which was quite, you know, heavily medical. I think he'd encouraged me a lot to, you know, start thinking about how I was going to get back into medicine and the correct pathway. And he sort of said, look, with this background, you should actually be applying to be an ACF, which gives you two rounds of applications to get into radiology after your PhD finishes. So you have the ACF round, which happens first, and then you have the main round of radiology recruitment. You could apply for both, and that sort of doubles your chances. And then, of course, I ruined everything by getting pregnant.
Happens to a lot of us.
Yeah. But in the end, I went to the ACF interview, and I did declare that I was pregnant, and it didn't stop them from offering me a job.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And so you went down that track?
Yes. Yeah. So I went off to Imperial to do my radiology training.
And did you take maternity leave and go back, or?
And so my maternity leave, yeah, my maternity leave was provided by the MRC. They were very generous. They kept the funding exactly the same. And I ended up taking 10 months before I was kind of itching to go back, really.
Mm-hmm.
And start my radiology training. And I started pre-revising the physics textbook.
Gosh. And did you work full time when you went back?
I did, yes. I've always worked full time, actually. I think in the beginning it was a sort of common sense financial decision of we won't afford nursery or childcare unless I'm working full time. And then I also realized that it was easier to be full time because, you know, to get the experience, to pass the exams, you just need as much exposure as possible. And I wanted to get that exposure quickly and pass those exams quickly and, you know, keep climbing through my training as quickly as possible. Money was very tight.
I can imagine. So you did. Did you go straight through and get your CCT?
Yes. I mean, I had another break for a second maternity leave, and it was not really plain sailing when I came back. My youngest at the age of one had a horrible, horrible RSV pneumonia with a secondary bacterial infection, ended up at the Evelina for a few days. And then from that period onwards, we seemed to be bouncing in and out of hospital quite regularly with him having very bad respiratory infections, getting investigated for having lymphadenopathy. And I sort of lived in a state of very, very high stress for about a year until they determined that, you know, things were stabilizing, his lung changes were not progressing. Yeah.
I often think that everything's good at work until somebody in the family, i.e. one of the children, isn't quite okay, and that pulls the rug, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Makes it much
harder. Yeah, you know, it meant my focus was really not on passing exams and, you know, being as good as I could at work. There was always some niggling worry at the back of my mind.
Mm.
And yeah, it was hard. The nurses knew who we were by name.
Gosh. So did you have to take time off work, or were you trying to juggle the two simultaneously?
It was a lot of juggling and a lot of calling in favours, actually, because I'd have to put a message on the group WhatsApp saying, I'm in hospital with my youngest again. I'm doing a night shift tomorrow. Can someone swap into it for me, please?
Gosh. And did people?
Yes.
How amazing. Yeah.
I had great support from the other registrars on the scheme. They were brilliant. There was always someone to volunteer to cover me, or always someone who was willing to do my ultrasound list so I could go home and pick whoever up from nursery was sick or who had chicken pox.
Gosh.
But actually, yeah.
I always think of it as being a bit of a juggler on a monocycle. You're just desperately trying to keep afloat, aren't you, to mix my metaphors. But you got through it?
I got through it, yeah, with the help of a lot of very nice mentors and my husband, who's really a rock and kept everything going. Probably at the expense of his career, actually, for those 5 years.
Was he medical?
He picked up all the slack of the childcare. He was taking the children for the entire weekend so I could sit there studying to pass my exams. Radiology is a very... He's not a doctor, no. He's an engineer. We actually met in the lab doing our PhDs.
So you then got your CCT?
Yes.
And got a consultant's post easily?
Yes. I mean, again, I think it was really a case of where having a good network has helped me, because I had a fabulous educational supervisor who was really on my side throughout all of my training. Also, you know, a clinical academic who had two children of her own, and she had done some a fellowship at Barts and worked with the director of research there, Prof. Andrew Sardev. And so this job came up and it was working very closely with Andrew. And I sort of said to my boss, I think I really want to apply for this. And she said, okay, well, let me have a chat with Andrew and you go and have a word with her, have a little tour of the department, speak to everyone you can. But you need to make sure this is really what you want, because I was training in nuclear medicine and the job that was being advertised was, it had one session of PET reporting, but the rest of it was MRI and CT.
Hmm.
So it was not a nuclear medicine job. So it was not really what I was training for at the time. But I just thought it was too good an opportunity to pass up, because it came with dedicated research time. And it was at a Central London Teaching Hospital. And then I went round and I met the department and everyone was just so welcoming and nice. I thought I could really work here.
And now you do?
Yes. Yeah, I've been there 4 years now.
Mm-hmm. So as a consultant for 4 years?
Yes. Yeah.
Congratulations. So we've talked a little bit about highs and lows, but do you think you've had any particular barriers, or has anything ever impacted you because of your gender or because of having two children, or has that all been easy? For some people it is.
So there were some barriers, yes. Even though I was full-time, quite a lot of the time I was treated as if I was part-time, and it became a long-standing joke because I reacted so strongly every time. So people would tease me and say, oh, you know, Kate, you're only part-time. And I would hit the roof because I'd heard it so many times. Oh, Kate, you probably don't have the time to get involved in this research project since you're only part-time. And I say, no, actually, I'm full-time. And yes, I do want to be involved.
Well, why did they assume that?
Because they knew I had children and I talked about my children a lot, and it just, you know, in radiology it's so easy and you're so well supported to be part-time that I think people just assumed.
But it's interesting,
I don't think
how
there was anything bad intention to it.
But it's interesting that they would assume you wouldn't want opportunities.
Yeah, but you know, having said that, I looked frazzled. I mean, I did not look like I was, you know, sailing through. And I was, you know, I had at that point, I had failed a few of my 2A exams as well. So I was beginning to get flagged as a, you know, a trainee who might be a trainee in difficulty because I wasn't able to pass the exams. And then one of my really crushing lows was when my children both got chicken pox, one after the other, and I forgot to apply for the next set of 2A exams. And these exams happen only every 6 months. Mm-hmm. And it was at the period of time when they were, so I was doing modular exams and they were turning it into one big long exam. So we had two tries left of these modular exams before I would have to resit it all as one big enormous exam. And I'd already passed four at this point. I had two left and only two sittings. And I'd forgotten to apply for one of those sittings. And it was a soul crushing, that feeling, in the pit of your stomach when you realise that you've made a really big mistake and it's going to really impact on your career. And I just remember standing in the staircase of the hospital with like tears spilling down my cheeks, thinking, how could I have been so stupid to have forgotten to apply for these exams? And then I went to my training program director and I said, is there any way you can put in a good word for me? Because this is, I can't delay things by another 6 months. And if I have to resit the whole exam, it's going to be a complete nightmare. And she said, oh, you know, the RCR have never, ever made any exception for any trainee in the history of the RCR. And I said, well, please, can you just send them an email? I'm going to call them right now and plead my case. And she did. She wrote a very good email. And I also asked my educational supervisor to write a begging email. And I spent 20 minutes on the phone to the lady at the Royal College. And I could tell that she was sympathetic. And sure enough, I think quite quickly they got back to me and said, due to your circumstances of both your children being ill and the fact that we're due to change the exam, we will let you put in a late application.
Phew.
But what amazing kindness in the end. Yeah,
that is great credit to them, actually, isn't it? Because the computer could have said no, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it would have been a real nightmare. And the stress of trying to pass those two exams in the last sitting on top of everything else.
Would have been too much. So also what's inspired you? You've talked about your father. You've talked about some of the educational supervisors along the way. Is there anything else that has inspired you and encouraged you to keep going?
I think I just enjoy problem solving and challenges. And I'm the type of person that doesn't like keep things that are unfinished. So I will just keep working and working at a project until we eventually reach a conclusion. And I think those are skills that have stood me well in research. And that's what inspires me. I want to discover new things. I want to help people. That's why I went into medicine in the first place, is because I thought I could make a difference and do something with my life that would benefit society. And
what a lovely altruistic way of looking at things. It's very refreshing to hear you say that. Now, you know, also sometimes being a doctor and working as hard as you have and having children, particularly sick children, impacts on people's personal life. Is there anything that you could share that would help others who might have just really struggled with all of that sort of thing going on in their lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think it hasn't impacted me so much as it's impacted the people around me. So, you know, my children who probably missed out on a lot of mummy time when they were small, I mean, they probably don't remember, but I will remember. So I have that guilt. And, you know, my husband, who had to keep everything going while I was cloistered in my room studying, eating licorice, all sorts. You know, my parents and my siblings, who I haven't seen as much as I should do, and all of the friends and the parties that I've missed. But, you know, everyone understands that being a doctor, you know, means sometimes having to put your patients and your work ahead of family and social activities. And I guess it helps having a lot of friends who are doctors in the end.
Yes, they understand. Actually, you know, so do family. I have to say my children have now got their own children. And I sort of feel as if maybe I neglected them, but they don't seem to remember, so I got away with it.
Did your children go into medicine, Jane?
No. No, yeah. So maybe that's them telling me.
I don't think mine will either, although I have
to say.
I think
if your mother's a doctor, maybe you think twice.
Yeah, maybe.
So just that last thing now, last things that have you got? So you've just sort of reached the top of that greasy pole as a consultant, and you know, what a journey. What advice would you give to those women who might be aspiring to come through and to be like you, to reach the stage of being a consultant and maybe go on to do other things?
So I would say find a good mentor. Find someone who's really got your corner and who will give you advice. You don't have to take that advice, but someone who will share their experience, because there's really a lot of value in listening to people who've been through it, even if times were different or exams were structured differently. You know, they will have been through the same struggles. And, you know, there were lots and lots of women, amazing women consultants at Imperial who had like 4 children. And you know, who've been really supportive. So you just need, the support is out there, you know, use your network, make friends wherever you go, because my work friends are now like my family.
And that's fantastic. Know, that's wonderful.
There is help available.
Excellent. Well, Kate, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Jane. It's been a pleasure to chat.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.